My Ashley. Beloved, I am coming home to you. Scarlett turned away, wordless. After that, Melanie noticed there was more food on the table when guests were present, even though Scarlett might grudge them every mouthful. When the soldiers were too ill to go on, and there were many such, Scarlett put them to bed with none too good grace. Each sick man meant another mouth to feed. Someone had to nurse him, and that meant one less worker at the business of fence-building, hoeing, weeding, and plowing. One boy, on whose face a blonde fuzz had just begun to sprout, was dumped on the front porch by a mounted soldier bound for Fayetteville. He had found him unconscious by the roadside and had brought him across his saddle to Tara, the nearest house. The girls thought he must be one of the little cadets who had been called out of military school when Sherman approached Milledgeville, but they never knew, for he died without regaining consciousness. And a search of his pockets yielded no information. A nice-looking boy, obviously a gentleman. And somewhere to the south, some woman was watching the roads, wondering where he was and when he was coming home. Just as she and Melanie, with a wild hope in their hearts, watched every bearded figure that came up their walk. They buried the cadet in the family burying ground, next to the three little O'Hara boys, and Melanie cried sharply as pork filled in the grave, wondering in her heart if strangers were doing this same thing to the tall body of Ashley. Will Benteen was another soldier, like the nameless boy, who arrived unconscious across the saddle of a comrade. Will was acutely ill with pneumonia, and when the girls put him to bed, they feared he would soon join the boy in the burying ground. He had the sallow malarial face of the South Georgia cracker, pale pinkish hair and washed-out blue eyes which even in delirium were patient and mild. One of his legs was gone at the knee, and to the stump was fitted a roughly whittled wooden peg. He was obviously a cracker, just as the boy they had buried so short a while ago was obviously a planter's son. Just how the girls knew this, they couldn't say. Certainly Will was no dirtier, no more hairy, no more lice-infested than many fine gentlemen who came to Tara. Certainly the language he used in his delirium was no less grammatical than that of the Tarleton twins. But they knew instinctively, as they knew thoroughbred horses from scrubs, that he was not of their class. But this knowledge did not keep them from laboring to save him. Emaciated from a year in a Yankee prison, exhausted by his long tramp on his ill-fitting wooden peg, he had little strength to combat pneumonia, and for days he lay in the bed moaning, trying to get up, fighting battles over again. Never once did he call for mother, wife, sister, or sweetheart. And this omission worried Corrine. "A man ought to have some folks," she said. "And he sounds like he didn't have a soul in the world." For all his lankiness, he was tough, and good nursing pulled him through. The day came when his pale blue eyes, perfectly cognizant of his surroundings, fell upon Corrine sitting beside him, telling her rosary beads, the morning sun shining through her fair hair. "Then you weren't a dream after all," he said, in his flat, toneless voice. "I hope I ain't troubled you too much, ma'am." His convalescence was a long one, and he lay quietly looking out of the window at the magnolias, and causing very little trouble to anyone. Corrine liked him because of his placid and unembarrassed silences. She would sit beside him through the long, hot afternoons, fanning him and saying nothing. Corrine had very little to say these days, as she moved, delicate and wraith-like, about the tasks which were within her strength. She prayed a good deal, for when Scarlett came into her room without knocking, she always found her on her knees by her bed, The sight never failed to annoy her, for Scarlet felt that the time for prayer had passed. If God had seen fit to punish them so, then God could very well do without prayers. Religion had always been a bargaining process with Scarlet. She promised God good behavior in exchange for favors. God had broken the bargain time and again, to her way of thinking, and she felt that she owed him nothing at all now. And whenever she found Corrine on her knees when she should have been taking an afternoon nap or doing the mending, she felt that Corrine was shirking her share of the burdens. She said as much to Will Benteen one afternoon when he was able to sit up in a chair and was startled when he said, in his flat voice, "Let her be, Miss Scarlet. It comforts her."
"Comforts her?"
"Yes. She's praying for your ma and him."
"Who is him?"
His faded blue eyes looked at her from under sandy lashes without surprise. Nothing seemed to surprise or excite him. Perhaps he had seen too much of the unexpected ever to be startled again. That Scarlet didn't know what was in her sister's heart did not seem odd to him. He took it as naturally as he did the fact that Corrine had found comfort in talking to him, a stranger. "Her beau. That boy Brent something or other who was killed at Gettysburg."
"Her beau?" said Scarlet shortly. "Her beau, nothing. He and his brother were my beaus."
"Yes, so she told me. Looks like most of the county was your beaus. But all the same, he was her beau after you turned him down, because when he come home on his last furlough, they got engaged. She said he was the only boy she ever cared about, and so it kind of comforts her to pray for him."
"Well, fiddly-dee," said Scarlet, a very small dart of jealousy entering her.
She looked curiously at this lanky man, with his bony stooped shoulders, his pinkish hair and calm, unwavering eyes. So he knew things about her own family which she had not troubled to discover. So that was why Corrine mooned about, praying all the time. Well, she'd get over it. Lots of girls got over dead sweethearts, yes, dead husbands, too. She'd certainly gotten over Charles. And she knew one girl in Atlanta who had been widowed 3 times by the war and was still able to take notice of men. She said as much to Will, but he shook his head. "Not Miss Corrine," he said with finality. Will was pleasant to talk to, because he had so little to say, and yet was so understanding a listener. She told him about her problems of weeding and hoeing and planting, of fattening the hogs and breeding the cow, and he gave good advice, for he had owned a small farm in South Georgia and 2 Negroes. He knew his slaves were free now and the farm gone to weeds and seedling pines. His sister, his only relative, had moved to Texas with her husband years ago, and he was alone in the world. Yet none of these things seemed to bother him any more than the leg he had left in Virginia. Yes, Will was a comfort to Scarlet after hard days when the Negroes muttered and Sue Ellen nagged and cried, and Gerald asked too frequently where Ellen was. She could tell Will anything. She even told him of killing the Yankee and glowed with pride when he commented briefly, "Good work." Eventually, all the family found their way to Will's room to air their troubles. Even Mammy, who had at first been distant with him because he was not quality and had owned only 2 slaves. When he was able to totter about the house, he turned his hands to weaving baskets of split oak and mending the furniture ruined by the Yankees. He was clever at whittling, and Wade was constantly by his side, for he whittled out toys for him, the only toys the little boy had. With Will in the house, everyone felt safe in leaving Wade and the 2 babies while they went about their tasks, for he could care for them as deftly as Mammy, and only Melly surpassed him at soothing the screaming black and white babies. You've been mighty good to me, Miss Scarlet, he said. And me a stranger, and nothing to you all. I've caused you a heap of trouble and worry, and if it's all the same to you, I'm going to stay here and help you all with the work, till I've paid you back some for your trouble. I can't ever pay it all, 'cause there ain't no payment a man can give for his life.
So he stayed. And gradually, unobtrusively, a large part of the burden of Tara shifted from Scarlet's shoulders to the bony shoulders of Will Benteen. It was September, and time to pick the cotton. Will Benteen sat on the front steps at Scarlet's feet in the pleasant sunshine of the early autumn afternoon, and his flat voice went on and on languidly about the exorbitant costs of ginning the cotton at the new gin near Fayetteville. However, he had learned that day in Fayetteville that he could cut this expense a fourth by lending the horse and wagon for 2 weeks to the gin owner. He had delayed closing the bargain until he discussed it with Scarlet. She looked at the lank figure leaning against the porch column, chewing a straw. Undoubtedly, as Mammy frequently declared, Will was something the Lord had provided, and Scarlet often wondered how Tara could have lived through the last few months without him. He never had much to say, never displayed any energy, never seemed to take much interest in anything that went on about him. But he knew everything about everybody at Tara. And he did things. He did them silently, patiently and competently. Though he had only one leg, he could work faster than pork. And he could get work out of pork, which was to Scarlet a marvelous thing. When the cow had the colic and the horse fell ill with a mysterious ailment which threatened to remove him permanently from them, Will sat up nights with them and saved them. That he was a shrewd trader brought him Scarlet's respect, for he could ride out in the mornings with a bushel or two of apples, sweet potatoes, and other vegetables, and return with seeds, lengths of cloth, flour, and other necessities which she knew she could never have acquired, good trader though she was. He had gradually slipped into the status of a member of the family, and slept on a cot in the little dressing room off Gerald's room. He said nothing of leaving Tara, and Scarlet was careful not to question him, fearful that he might leave them. Sometimes she thought that if he were anybody and had any gumption, he would go home, even if he no longer had a home. But even with this thought, she would pray fervently that he would remain indefinitely. It was so convenient to have a man about the house. She thought, too, that if Corrine had the sense of a mouse, she would see that Will cared for her. Scarlet would have been eternally grateful to Will had he asked her for Corrine's hand. Of course, before the war, Will would certainly not have been an eligible suitor. He was not of the planter class at all, though he was not poor white. He was just plain Cracker, a small farmer, half-educated, prone to grammatical errors and ignorant of some of the finer manners the O'Haras were accustomed to in gentlemen. In fact, Scarlet wondered if he could be called a gentleman at all, and decided that he couldn't. Melanie hotly defended him, saying that anyone who had Will's kind heart and thoughtfulness of others was of gentle birth. Scarlet knew that Ellen would have fainted at the thought of a daughter of hers marrying such a man. But now Scarlet had been by necessity forced too far away from Ellen's teachings to let that worry her. Men were scarce. Girls had to marry someone, and Tara had to have a man. But Corrine, deeper and deeper immersed in her prayer book, and every day losing more of her touch with the world of realities, treated Will as gently as a brother, and took him as much for granted as she did pork. If Corrine had any sense of gratitude to me for what I've done for her, She'd marry him and not let him get away from here, Scarlet thought indignantly. But no, she must spend her time mooning about a silly boy who probably never gave her a serious thought. So Will remained at Terra. For what reason, she didn't know. And she found his businesslike man-to-man attitude with her both pleasant and helpful. He was gravely deferential to the vague Gerald, but it was to Scarlet that he turned as the real head of the house. She gave her approval to the plan of hiring out the horse, even though it meant the family would be without any means of transportation temporarily. Sue Ellen would be especially grieved at this. Her greatest joy lay in going to Jonesboro or Fayetteville with Will when he drove over on business. Adorned in the assembled best of the family, she called on old friends, heard all the gossip of the county, and felt herself again Miss O'Hara of Terra. Sue Ellen never missed the opportunity to leave the plantation and give herself airs among people who didn't know she weeded the garden and made beds. Miss Fine Airs will just have to do without gadding for 2 weeks, thought Scarlet. And we'll have to put up with her nagging and her bawling. Melanie joined them on the veranda, the baby in her arms, and spreading an old blanket on the floor, set little Beau down to crawl. Since Ashley's letter, Melanie had divided her time between glowing, singing happiness, and anxious longing. But happy or depressed, she was too thin, too white. She did her share of the work uncomplainingly, but she was always ailing. Old Dr. Fontaine diagnosed her trouble as female complaint, and concurred with Dr. Meade in saying she should never have had Beau. And he said frankly that another baby would kill her.
"When I was over to Fayetteville today," said Will, "I found something right cute that I thought would interest you ladies, and I brought it home."
He fumbled in his back pants pocket and brought out the wallet of calico stiffened with bark, which Corrine had made him. From it, he drew a Confederate bill.
"If you think Confederate money is cute, Will, I certainly don't," said Scarlet shortly, for the very sight of Confederate money made her mad.
"We've got $3,000 of it in Pa's trunk this minute, and Mammy's after me to let her paste it over the holes in the attic walls so the draft won't get her, and I think I'll do it. Then it'll be good for something."
"Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay," said Melanie with a sad smile. "Don't do that, Scarlet. Keep it for Wade. He'd be proud of it some day."
"Well, I don't know nothing about Imperious Caesar," said Will patiently. "But what I've got is in line with what you've just said about Wade, Miss Melly. It's a poem, pasted on back of this bill. I know Miss Scarlet ain't much on poems, but I thought this might interest her."
He turned the bill over. On its back was pasted a strip of coarse brown wrapping paper, inscribed in pale, homemade ink. Will cleared his throat and read slowly and with difficulty.
"The name is Lines on the Back of a Confederate Note," he said. "Representing nothing on God's earth now, and not in the waters below it. As the pledge of a nation that's passed away, keep it, dear friend, and show it. Show it to those who will lend an ear to the tale this trifle will tell, of liberty, born of patriot's dream, of a storm-cradled nation that fell."
"Oh, how beautiful, how touching," cried Melanie. "Scarlet, you mustn't give the money to Mammy to paste in the attic. It's more than paper, just like the poem said, the pledge of a nation that's passed away."
Oh, Mellie, don't be sentimental. Paper is paper, and we've got little enough of it. And I'm tired of hearing Mammy grumble about the cracks in the attic. I hope when Wade grows up I'll have plenty of greenbacks to give him instead of Confederate trash. Will, who had been enticing little Beau across the blanket with a bill during this argument, looked up and, shading his eyes, glanced down the driveway.
"More company," he said, squinting in the sun. "Another soldier."
Scarlet followed his gaze and saw a familiar sight. A bearded man coming slowly up the avenue under the cedars. A man clad in a ragged mixture of blue and gray uniforms, head bowed tiredly, feet dragging slowly.
"I thought we were about through with soldiers," she said. "I hope this one isn't very hungry."
"He'll be hungry," said Will briefly.
Melanie rose. "I'd better tell Dilsey to set an extra plate," she said, "and warn Mammy not to get the poor thing's clothes off his back too abruptly, and—" She stopped so suddenly that Scarlet turned to look at her. Melanie's thin hand was at her throat, clutching it as if it was torn with pain, and Scarlet could see the veins beneath the white skin throbbing swiftly. Her face went whiter, and her brown eyes dilated enormously. "She's going to faint," thought Scarlet, leaping to her feet and catching her arm. But in an instant, Melanie threw off her hand and was down the steps. Down the graveled path she flew, skimming lightly as a bird, her faded skirt streaming behind her, her arms outstretched. Then Scarlet knew the truth with the impact of a blow. She reeled back against an upright of the porch as the man lifted a face covered with a dirty blonde beard and stopped still, looking toward the house as if he was too weary to take another step. Her heart leaped and stopped, and then began racing, as Mellie, with incoherent cries, threw herself into the dirty soldier's arms, and his head bent down toward hers. With rapture, Scarlet took two running steps forward, but was checked when Will's hand closed upon her skirt.
"Don't spoil it," he said quietly.
"Turn me loose, you fool! Turn me loose! It's Ashley!"
He did not relax his grip.
"After all, he's her husband, ain't he?"
Will asked calmly, and, looking down at him, in a confusion of joy and impotent fury, Scarlet saw in the quiet depths of his eyes understanding and pity. Part 4. Chapter 31. On a cold January afternoon in 1866, Scarlet sat in the office writing a letter to Aunt Pity, explaining in detail for the 10th time why neither she, Melanie, nor Ashley could come back to Atlanta to live with her. She wrote impatiently because she knew Aunt Pity would read no farther than the opening lines, and then write her again, wailing,
"But I'm afraid to live by myself."
Her hands were chilled, and she paused to rub them together and to scuff her feet deeper into the strip of old quilting wrapped about them. The soles of her slippers were practically gone, and were reinforced with pieces of carpet. The carpet kept her feet off the floor, but did little to keep them warm. That morning Will had taken the horse to Jonesboro to get him shod. Scarlet thought grimly that things were indeed at a pretty pass, when horses had shoes and people's feet were as bare as yard dogs. She picked up her quill to resume her writing, but laid it down when she heard Will coming in at the back door. She heard the thump-thump of his wooden leg in the hall outside the office, and then he stopped. She waited for a moment for him to enter, and when he made no move, she called to him. He came in, his ears red from the cold, his pinkish hair awry, and stood looking down at her, a faintly humorous smile on his lips. Miss Scarlet, he questioned, just how much cash money have you got?
Are you going to try to marry me for my money, Will? She asked somewhat crossly.
No, ma'am. I just wanted to know.
She stared at him inquiringly. Will didn't look serious, but then he never looked serious. However, she felt that something was wrong.
I've got $10 in gold, she said.
The last of that Yankee's money.
Well, ma'am, that won't be enough.
Enough for what?
Enough for the taxes, he answered, and stumping over to the fireplace, he leaned down and held his red hands to the blaze.
Taxes? She repeated. Name of God, Will! We've already paid the taxes.
Yes'm. But they say you didn't pay enough. I heard about it today over to Jonesboro.
But, Will, I can't understand. What do you mean?
Miss Scarlet, I sure hate to bother you with more trouble when you've had your share, but I've got to tell you. They say you ought to pay lots more taxes than you did. They're running the assessment up on Terra sky high. Higher than any in the county, I'll be bound.
But they can't make us pay more taxes when we've already paid them once.
Miss Scarlet, you don't never go to Jonesboro often, and I'm glad you don't. It ain't no place for a lady these days. But if you'd been there much, you'd know there's a mighty rough bunch of scallywags and Republicans and carpetbaggers been running things recently. They'd make you mad enough to pop. And then, too, niggers pushing white folks off the sidewalks and...
But what's that got to do with our taxes?
I'm getting to it, Miss Scarlet. For some reason, the rascals have heisted the taxes on Terra till you'd think it was a thousand-bale place. After I heard about it, I sort of oozed round the barrooms picking up gossip, and I found out that somebody wants to buy in Terra cheap, at the sheriff's sale, if you can't pay the extra taxes. And everybody knows pretty well that you can't pay them. I don't know yet who it is wants this place. I couldn't find out. But I think that pusillanimous feller, Hilton, that married Miss Kathleen knows, 'cause he laughed kinda nasty when I tried to sound him out. Will sat down on the sofa and rubbed the stump of his leg. It ached in cold weather, and the wooden peg was neither well padded nor comfortable. Scarlet looked at him wildly. His manner was so casual when he was sounding the death knell of Terra. Sold out at the sheriff's sale? Where would they all go? And Terra belonging to someone else? No, that was unthinkable. She had been so engrossed with the job of making Terra produce, she had paid little heed to what was going on in the world outside. Now that she had Will and Ashley to attend to whatever business she might have in Jonesboro and Fayetteville, she seldom left the plantation. And even as she had listened with deaf ears to her father's war talk in the days before the war came, so she had paid little heed to Will and Ashley's discussions around the table after supper about the beginnings of Reconstruction. Oh, of course she knew about the scallywags, Southerners who had turned Republican very profitably, and the carpetbaggers, those Yankees who came south like buzzards after the surrender, with all their worldly possessions in one carpet bag. And she had had a few unpleasant experiences with the Freedmen's Bureau. She had gathered also that some of the free Negroes were getting quite insolent. This last she could hardly believe, for she had never seen an insolent Negro in her life. But there were many things which Will and Ashley had conspired to keep from her. The scourge of war had been followed by the worst scourge of Reconstruction. But the two men had agreed not to mention the more alarming details when they discussed the situation at home. And when Scarlet took the trouble to listen to them at all, most of what they said went in one ear and out the other. She had heard Ashley say that the South was being treated as a conquered province, and that vindictiveness was the dominant policy of the conquerors.
But that was the kind of statement which meant less than nothing at all to Scarlett. Politics was men's business. She had heard Will say it looked to him like the North just wasn't aiming to let the South get on its feet again. Well, thought Scarlett, men always had to have something foolish to worry about. As far as she was concerned, the Yankees hadn't whipped her once, and they wouldn't do it this time. The thing to do was to work like the devil and stop worrying about the Yankee government. After all, the war was over. Scarlett didn't realize that all the rules of the game had been changed, and that honest labor could no longer earn its just reward. Georgia was virtually under martial law now. The Yankee soldiers garrisoned throughout the section, and the Freedmen's Bureau were in complete command of everything, and they were fixing the rules to suit themselves. This bureau, organized by the federal government to take care of the idle and excited ex-slaves, was drawing them from the plantations into the villages and cities by the thousands. The bureau fed them while they loafed and poisoned their minds against their former owners. Gerald's old overseer, Jonas Wilkerson, was in charge of the local bureau, and his assistant was Hilton, Kathleen Calvert's husband. These two industriously spread the rumor that the Southerners and Democrats were just waiting for a good chance to put the Negroes back into slavery, and that the Negroes' only hope of escaping this fate was the protection given them by the Bureau and the Republican Party. Wilkerson and Hilton, furthermore, told the Negroes they were as good as the whites in every way, and soon white and Negro marriages would be permitted. Soon the estates of their former owners would be divided, and every Negro would be given 40 acres and a mule for his own. They kept the Negroes stirred up with tales of cruelty perpetrated by the whites, and in a section long famed for the affectionate relations between slaves and slave owners, hate and suspicion began to grow. The Bureau was backed up by the soldiers, and the military had issued many and conflicting orders governing the conduct of the conquered. It was easy to get arrested, even for snubbing the officials of the Bureau. Military orders had been promulgated concerning the schools, sanitation, the kind of buttons one wore on one's suit, the sale of commodities, and nearly everything else. Wilkerson and Hilton had the power to interfere in any trade Scarlett might make, and to fix their own prices on anything she sold or swapped. Fortunately, Scarlett had come into contact with the two men very little, for Will had persuaded her to let him handle the trading while she managed the plantation. In his mild-tempered way, Will had straightened out several difficulties of this kind and said nothing to her about them. Will could get along with carpetbaggers and Yankees if he had to. But now, a problem had arisen which was too big for him to handle. The extra tax assessment and the danger of losing Terra were matters Scarlett had to know about. And right away, she looked at him with flashing eyes. "Oh, damn, the Yankees!" she cried. "Isn't it enough that they've licked us and beggared us without turning loose scoundrels on us?" The war was over. Peace had been declared. But the Yankees could still rob her. They could still starve her. They could still drive her from her house. And fool that she was, she had thought through weary months that if she could just hold on until spring, everything would be all right. This crushing news brought by Will, coming on top of a year of back-breaking work and hope deferred, was the last straw. "Oh, Will, I thought our troubles were all over when the war ended." "No." Will raised his lantern-jawed, country-looking face and gave her a long, steady look. "Our troubles are just getting started."
"How much extra taxes do they want us to pay?"
$300. She was struck dumb for a moment. $300? It might just as well be $3 million.
Why, she floundered. Why, then we've got to raise 300 somehow.
Yes'm. And a rainbow and a moon or two.
Oh, but Will, they couldn't sell out Tara. Why?
His mild, pale eyes showed more hate and bitterness than she thought possible.
Oh, couldn't they? Well, they could and they will, and they'll lack doing it.
Miss Scarlet, the country's gone plumb to hell, if you'll pardon me. Those carpetbaggers and scallywags can vote, and most of us Democrats can't. Can't no Democrat in this state vote if he was on the tax books for more than $2,000.65. That lets out folks like your pa and Mr. Tarleton and the MacRae's and the Fontaine boys. Can't nobody vote who was a colonel and over in the war. And Miss Scarlet, I bet this state's got more colonels than any state in the Confederacy.
And can't nobody vote who held office under the Confederate government, and that lets out everybody from the notaries to the judges. And the woods are full of folks like that. The fact is, the way the Yankees have framed up that amnesty oath, can't nobody who was somebody before the war vote at all. Not the smart folks, nor the quality folks, nor the rich folks. I could vote if I took the damned oath. I didn't have any money in 65, and I certainly weren't a colonel, nor nothing remarkable.
But I ain't going to take the oath. Not by a dinged sight. If the Yankees had acted right, I'd have taken the oath of allegiance, but I ain't now. I can be restored to the Union, but I can't be reconstructed into it. I ain't going to take the oath even if I don't never vote again. But scum like that Hilton fella, he can vote. And scoundrels like Jonas Wilkerson. And poor whites like the Slatterys and no-counts like the McIntoshes, they can vote. And they're running things now. And if they want to come down on you for extra taxes a dozen times, they can do it. Just like a nigger can kill a white man and not get hung.
He paused, embarrassed. And the memory of what had happened to a lone white woman on an isolated farm near Lovejoy was in both their minds. Those niggers can do anything against us, and the Freedmen's Bureau and the soldiers will back them up with guns. And we can't vote or do nothing about it.
Vote! She cried. Vote! What on earth has voting got to do with all this, Will? It's taxes we're talking about. Well, everybody knows what a good plantation Tara is. We could mortgage it for enough to pay the taxes if we had to.
Miss Scarlet, you ain't any fool, but sometimes you talk like one. Who's got any money to lend you on this property? Who except the carpetbaggers who are trying to take Tara away from you? Why, everybody's got land. Everybody's land poor. You can't give away land.
I've got those diamond earbobs I got off that Yankee. We could sell them.
Miss Scarlet, who round here has got money for earbobs? Folks ain't got money to buy side meat, let alone gigaws. If you've got $10 in gold, I'll take oath that's more than most folks have got.
They were silent again, and Scarlet felt as if she were butting her head against a stone wall. There had been so many stone walls to butt against this last year.
What are we going to do, Miss Scarlet?
I don't know, she said dully, and felt that she didn't care. This was one stone wall too many, and she suddenly felt so tired that her bones ached. Why should she work and struggle and wear herself out? At the end of every struggle, it seemed that defeat was waiting to mock her.
I don't know, she said. But don't let Paul know. It might worry him.
I won't.
Have you told anyone?
No, I came right to you.
Yes, she thought.
Everyone always came right to her with bad news, and she was tired of it.
Where's Mr. Wilkes? Perhaps he'll have some suggestion.
Will turned his mild gaze on her, and she felt, as from the first day when Ashley came home, that he knew everything.
He's down in the orchard splitting rails. I heard his axe when I was putting up the horse. But he ain't got any money any more than we have.
If I want to talk to him about it, I can't I? She snapped, rising to her feet and kicking the fragment of quilting from her ankles.
Will didn't take offense, but continued rubbing his hands before the flame.
Better get your shawl, Miss Scarlet. It's raw outside.
But she went without the shawl, for it was upstairs, and her need to see Ashley and lay her troubles before him was too urgent to wait. How lucky for her if she could find him alone! Never once since his return had she had a private word with him. Always the family clustered about him. Always Melanie was by his side, touching his sleeve now and again, to reassure herself he was really there. The sight of that happy, possessive gesture had aroused in Scarlet all the jealous animosity which had slumbered during the months when she had thought Ashley probably dead. Now she was determined to see him alone. This time, no one was going to prevent her from talking with him alone. She went through the orchard under the bare boughs, and the damp weeds beneath them wet her feet. She could hear the sound of the axe ringing as Ashley split into rails the logs hauled from the swamp. Replacing the fences the Yankees had so blithely burned was a long, hard task. Everything was a long, hard task, she thought wearily, as she was tired of it, tired and mad and sick of it all. If only Ashley were her husband instead of Melanie's, how sweet it would be to go to him and lay her head upon his shoulder and cry, and shove her burdens onto him, to work out as best he might. She rounded a thicket of pomegranate trees, which were shaking bare limbs in the cold wind, and saw him leaning on his axe, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand. He was wearing the remains of his butternut trousers, and one of Gerald's shirts, a shirt which in better times went only to court days and barbecues, a ruffled shirt, which was far too short for its present owner. He had hung his coat on a tree limb, for the work was hot, and he stood resting as she came up to him. At the sight of Ashley in rags, with an axe in his hand, her heart went out in a surge of love and of fury at fate. She couldn't bear to see him in tatters working, her debonair, immaculate Ashley. His hands were not made for work, or his body for anything but broadcloth and fine linen. God intended him to sit in a great house, talking with pleasant people, playing the piano and writing things which sounded beautiful and made no sense whatsoever. She could endure the sight of her own child in aprons made of sacking, and the girls in dingy old gingham, could bear it that Will worked harder than any field hand, but not Ashley. He was too fine for all this, too infinitely dear to her. She would rather split logs herself than suffer while he did it.
"They say Abe Lincoln got his start splitting rails," he said as she came up to him. "Just think to what heights I may climb."
She frowned. He was always saying light things like this about their hardships. They were deadly serious matters to her, and sometimes she was almost irritated at his remarks. Abruptly she told him Will's news, tersely and in short words, feeling a sense of relief as she spoke. Surely he'd have something helpful to offer. He said nothing. But, seeing her shiver, he took his coat and placed it about her shoulders. Well, she said finally, doesn't it occur to you that we'll have to get the money somewhere?
Yes, he said. But where?
I'm asking you, she replied, annoyed. The sense of relief at unburdening herself had disappeared. Even if he couldn't help, why didn't he say something comforting? Even if it was only, oh, I'm so sorry.
He smiled. In all these months since I've been home, I've only heard of one person, Rhett Butler, who actually has money, he said.
At Pitypat had written Melanie the week before that Rhett was back in Atlanta, with a carriage and two fine horses and pocketfuls of greenbacks. She had intimated, however, that he didn't come by them honestly. Aunt Pity had a theory, largely shared by Atlanta, that Rhett had managed to get away with the mythical millions of the Confederate treasury.
"Don't let's talk about him," said Scarlett shortly. "He's a skunk if ever there was one. What's to become of us all?"
Ashley put down the axe and looked away, and his eyes seemed to be journeying to some far-off country where she could not follow.
"I wonder," he said. "I wonder not only what will become of us at Terra, but what will become of everybody in the South."
She felt like snapping out abruptly, "To hell with everybody in the South! What about us?"
But she remained silent, because the tired feeling was back on her more strongly than ever. Ashley wasn't being any help at all. "In the end, what will happen will be what has happened whenever a civilization breaks up. The people who have brains and courage come through, and the ones who haven't are winnowed out. At least, it has been interesting, if not comfortable, to witness a Goethe Dämmerung."
"A what?"
"A dusk of the gods. Unfortunately, we Southerners did think we were gods."
"For heaven's sake, Ashley Wilkes, don't stand there and talk nonsense at me when it's us who are going to be winnowed out."
Something of her exasperated weariness seemed to penetrate his mind, calling it back from its wanderings, for he raised her hands with tenderness and, turning them palm up, looked at the calluses.
"These are the most beautiful hands I know," he said. And he kissed each palm lightly. "They are beautiful because they are strong, and every callus is a metal scarlet, every blister an award for bravery and unselfishness. They've been roughened for all of us, your father, the girls, Melanie, the baby, the Negroes, and for me. My dear, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, here stands an impractical fool talking tommyrot about dead gods when living people are in danger. Isn't that true?" She nodded, wishing he would keep on holding her hands forever. But he dropped them. "And you came to me hoping I could help you." "Well, I can't." His eyes were bitter as he looked toward the axe and the pile of logs. "My home is gone, and all the money that I so took for granted I never realized I had it. And I am fitted for nothing in this world, for the world I belonged in has gone. I can't help you, Scarlett, except by learning with as good grace as possible to be a clumsy farmer. And that won't keep Terra for you. Don't you think I realize the bitterness of our situation, living here on your charity? Oh, yes, Scarlett, your charity. I can never repay you what you've done for me, and for mine out of the kindness of your heart. I realize it more acutely every day. And every day I see more clearly how helpless I am to cope with what has come on us all. Every day, my accursed shrinking from realities makes it harder for me to face the new realities. Do you know what I mean?
She nodded. She had no very clear idea what he meant, but she clung breathlessly on his words. This was the first time he had ever spoken to her of the things he was thinking when he seemed so remote from her. It excited her, as if she were on the brink of a discovery. "It's a curse, this not wanting to look on naked realities. Until the war, life was never more real to me than a shadow show on a curtain, and I preferred it so. I do not like the outlines of things to be too sharp. I like them gently blurred, a little hazy." He stopped and smiled faintly, shivering a little as the cold wind went through his thin shirt. "In other words, Scarlet, I'm a coward." His talk of shadow shows and hazy outlines conveyed no meaning to her, but his last words were in a language she could understand. She knew they were untrue. Cowardice was not in him. Every line of his slender body spoke of generations of brave and gallant men, and Scarlet knew his war record by heart. "Why, that's not so. Would a coward have climbed on the cannon at Gettysburg and rallied the men? Would the general himself have written Melanie a letter about a coward? And that's not courage," he said tiredly. "Fighting is like champagne. It goes to the heads of cowards as quickly as of heroes. Any fool can be brave on a battlefield when it's be brave or else be killed. I'm talking of something else. And my kind of cowardice is infinitely worse than if I had run the first time I heard a cannon fired." His words came slowly and with difficulty, as if it hurt to speak them. And he seemed to stand off and look with a sad heart at what he had said. Had any other man spoken so, Scarlet would have dismissed such protestations contemptuously as mock modesty and a bid for praise. But Ashley seemed to mean them, and there was a look in his eyes which eluded her, not fear, not apology, but the bracing to a strain which was inevitable and overwhelming. The wintry wind swept her damp ankles, and she shivered again, but her shiver was less from the wind than from the dread his words evoked in her heart. "But, Ashley, what are you afraid of?" "Oh, nameless things. Things which sound very silly when they are put into words. Mostly of having life suddenly become too real. Of being brought into too personal contact with some of the simple facts of life. It isn't that I mind splitting logs here in the mud, but I do mind what it stands for. I do mind very much the loss of the beauty of the old life I loved. Scarlet, before the war, life was beautiful. There was a glamour to it, a perfection and a completeness and a symmetry to it, like Grecian art. Maybe it wasn't so to everyone. I know that now. But to me, living at 12 Oaks, there was a real beauty to living. I belonged in that life. I was a part of it. And now it's gone, and I am out of place in this new life. And I'm afraid. Now I know that in the old days it was a shadow show I watched. I avoided everything which was not shadowy, people and situations which were too real, too vital. I resented their intrusion. I tried to avoid you too, Scarlet. You were too full of living and too real, and I was cowardly enough to prefer shadows and dreams. But, Melly... Melanie is the gentlest of dreams, and a part of my dreaming. And if the war had not come, I would have lived out my life happily buried at 12 Oaks, contentedly watching life go by, and never being a part of it.
But when the war came, life as it really is thrust itself against me. The first time I went into action, it was at Bull Run, you remember. I saw my boyhood friends blown to bits and heard dying horses scream and learned the sickeningly horrible feeling of seeing men crumple up and spit blood when I shot them. But those weren't the worst things about the war, Scarlet. The worst thing about the war was the people I had to live with. I'd sheltered myself from people all my life. I had carefully selected my few friends. But the war taught me I had created a world of my own with dream people in it. It taught me what people really are. But it didn't teach me how to live with them. And I'm afraid I'll never learn. Now I know that in order to support my wife and child, I will have to make my way among a world of people with whom I have nothing in common. You, Scarlet, are taking life by the horns and twisting it to your will. But where do I fit in the world anymore? I tell you, I'm afraid. While his low, resonant voice went on desolate, with a feeling she could not understand, Scarlet clutched at words here and there, trying to make sense of them. But the words swooped from her hands like wild birds. Something was driving him with a cruel goad, but she did not understand what it was. Scarlet, I don't know just when it was that the bleak realization came over me that my own private shadow show was over. Perhaps in the first 5 minutes at Bull Run when I saw the first man I killed drop to the ground. But I knew it was over, and I could no longer be a spectator. No, I suddenly found myself on the curtain, an actor, posturing and making futile gestures. My little inner world was gone, invaded by people whose thoughts were not my thoughts, whose actions were as alien as a Hottentot's. They'd tramped through my world with slimy feet, and there was no place left where I could take refuge when things became too bad to stand. When I was in prison, I thought, when the war is over, I can go back to the old life and the old dreams and watch the shadow show again. But, Scarlet, there's no going back. And this which is facing all of us now is worse than war and worse than prison and, to me, worse than death. So you see, Scarlet, I'm being punished for being afraid. Ashley, she began, floundering in a quagmire of bewilderment. If you're afraid we'll starve, Ashley will manage somehow. I know we will. For a moment, his eyes came back to her, wide and crystal gray, and there was admiration in them. Then suddenly they were remote again, and she knew with a sinking heart that he had not been thinking about starving. They were always like two people talking to each other in different languages. But she loved him so much that when he withdrew, as he had now done, it was like the warm sun going down and leaving her in chilly twilight dews. She wanted to catch him by the shoulders and hug him to her, make him realize that she was flesh and blood and not something he had read or dreamed. If she could only feel that sense of oneness with him, for which she had yearned since that day so long ago when he had come home from Europe and stood on the steps of Terra and smiled up at her. "Starving's not pleasant," he said. "I know, for I've starved, but I'm not afraid of that. I'm afraid of facing life without the slow beauty of our old world that is gone." Scarlet thought despairingly that Melanie would know what he meant. Melanie and he were always talking such foolishness, poetry and books and dreams and moon rays and stardust. He was not fearing the things she feared, not the gnawing of an empty stomach, nor the keenness of the winter wind, nor eviction from Terra.
He was shrinking before some fear she